Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy and pluralism. This is Omar Sadr, a research associate at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. Today, I'm excited to bring you a fascinating conversation with Adam Basco about his groundbreaking book, The Taliban Courts in Afghanistan. Originally published in French and recently translated into English by Oxford University Press in 2023, the work tackles some of the most compelling questions about justice and authority in conflict zones, particularly Afghanistan. Basco, a research associate professor at Center for International Studies, Sciences Po Paris, delves deep into complex relationship between judicial power and political legitimacy. At the heart of his research lies two crucial questions. How does an armed movement convince a population that its judicial decisions are legitimate rather than purely political? And how did the Taliban judges, who simultaneously embody both judicial and militant rules, establish their authority within communities? Join us as we explore these intriguing questions and paradoxes and uncover findings from Basco's extensive research. Adam Basco, welcome to Negotiating Ideas. I'm thrilled to have you on this episode. The Taliban Courts in Afghanistan was a wonderful read. Why don't we start with you briefing us about what this book is about?
Thank you, Omar, for this invitation. I'm glad we for this opportunity to explain a bit more about my research. So the book shows how the Taliban built a court system that contributed to their victory in 2021. What the book shows is basically first that one cannot understand the success of the Taliban if he doesn't understand the failure of the Western intervention. Building a judicial system is always, in the context of civil war, a relational process. It's related to what other belligerent, other actors, other international actors also, are doing in that situation. The Taliban succeeded where the West and the regime that the West constructed failed, because they bet on low-end institution to organize society. They did that by using the fact that they had, as a movement made of ulema, made of religious scholars, an ability to recruit judges in religious school that were all the more legitimate to be judges that they were autonomous from the movement. That ability to construct a system was supplemented by a tendency to insist on institutional processes to integrate those judges inside the institution. My argument for Afghanistan, even in a larger way for any civil war, is that what makes a judicial system recognized by the population, that makes it what makes it effective in the context of civil war, is its ability. Is the ability of the armed movement to respect its own rules, to be previsible, to allow people in the context of radical legal uncertainty to have some level of previsibility. And the Taliban did that. And by doing that, I argue, it allowed them to penetrate society, to present their ideology and their ideas not as political a concept that should be debated or that people could resent, but as technical solution to technical problem, as legal solution to the problem that people were presented to them, such as land issues or matrimonial issues or commercial problems. It allowed the Taliban to present their vision, this is to say a monopoly of the ulema over the governing of society, as the result of just having to deal with the consequences of the civil war.
How did you get interested on Afghanistan and studying particularly the Taliban and their judiciary system, justice system, and the courts? As you have explained in your book, you have lived for a long period of time throughout several provinces in the country. I understand that was quite difficult, given the insurgency and the last 20 years before fall of Kabul to the Taliban. So the audience might be interested to know, first of all, tell us the process, how you get interested, and then how did you negotiate it, your research in terms of methodology with the locals, with insurgents, and how did you ensure your own safety?
So I started working on the Taliban through an interest on the Western intervention. There was something of a paradox to me. I was a young Frenchman doing an MA, interested in what the West was doing, especially in the Middle East and Central Asia, at that time of multiple U.S. interventions. And there was this paradox for me of the Taliban progressing in front of a coalition of technologically superior armies, while being at the same time described as a group that had no consideration for the civilian population, that was it's probably one of the contemporary incarnation of evil in the way the group is depicted in Western medias or even in part of academia. And so there was this paradox. We know an insurgency that progress in front of an army has some kind of popular support, has some kind of ability or taking into account the needs or the demands, the social demands of the population. And there was this mystery for me of the Taliban being described on the one hand as a barbarous movement, medieval, and on the other hand, the fact that they were actually winning the war in front of the US and European armies. In terms of negotiating access, it was both difficult and easy. I used something quite classical in field-based research, which is called snowball sampling. It's basically you start by having a contact, which would put you in touch with people he knows. And when I was writing the book, I understood rather at the end of the process, because research is such a type of research in a war-ridden country is both a deductive and inductive process. Negotiating access was both difficult and easy. Easy in the sense that when I started doing this research, I met various people that were interested in having this research done, in people in Afghanistan that wanted to have another point of view given of their situation and then the one that was dominant in the media and in the academia. And so I used a very classical methodology, snowball sampling, where basically you speak with a person that gives you access to his network or his contacts or his family. All in all, at the end, there are five key people, not more, that allowed me to gain the first access, that allowed me to meet more people little by little, until I could discuss with court users, Taliban judges, Taliban commanders or militants, but also people that had not used the courts but were living in places where the Taliban were in control and so had a lot to say about what it meant to live under Taliban rule. The difficult part was, of course, the insecurity. Every displacement was requiring a lot of preparation. 9 times out of 10, my interlocutors told me not to come. It's the type of research where you have to wait a lot and you have to be patient. But there is, on the other hand, a serendipity to it. I came with questions that were relating with governance. I have a background in political science. I have no legal background. And so I didn't come with the idea that courts were so important. I discovered it by discussing with people. When I would ask questions about the Taliban, people would be very afraid to answer. But when what they wanted to speak about and what I would let them speak about were their court case, the land conflicts, because that was questions that for them was so important. And so little by little, I understood that the question I wanted to ask were not the right questions, and the question that I should ask were about this justice system that played such an important role in the daily life of people in the countryside.
Sure. So on that, you argue that far from being an anarchic group, the Taliban has a legal and a moral vision of politics, that their judiciary and judges operate based on that moral and legal vision. To a large extent, that vision is rested on Deobandi ideology. But as an insurgency, how do you, that's crux of your book, I think. So how do you explain or to the readers, to the audience, the Taliban vision of politics, both in terms of, so this will be very broad. You discuss their vision in terms of social order, gender, land distribution, and hierarchies in society, and the place of ulama in the top. So how is that? How the Taliban has developed a kind of a vision of politics?
Well, that's the core argument of the book. Of course, the procedures that the Taliban are putting in place are rudimentary, and it's easy to project on them the idea that this is an archaic group and not see how the modernity of their ideology or of their functioning. But when you speak with the judges, especially the Taliban judges, are particularly interesting in the sense that they are a very homogeneous group. And the Taliban are very much misunderstood because they are by not looking at the sociology of the group, we miss the fact that far from being just a bunch of people that express loudly extremist ideas, the Taliban are actually a professional group. They're a group characterized by the fact that they are graduates of the religious schools, the madrasas, of the Deobandi movement in northern Pakistan. The Taliban appeared in 1994 when, in the midst of one of the worst moments of the civil war in Afghanistan, one of the moments where the atrocities were at the highest, a group of graduates of those schools created a sort of vigilant group that became little by little an armed group with the help of Pakistan, of course, that played a big role as a sponsor, but also by being rooted in those religious schools. In those religious schools, and the people that created this group, they're not any student. They're not just people that had a basic education. They often graduate in Islamic law or Islamic theology. To say it in a clearer way, what they are basically are, they look at themselves as people able to interpret the law. They look at themselves as judges. That explains why in the 1990s, as in the 2000s, they put so much emphasis on courts. It's because they look at their role in society as people that should regulate the social life. They look at themselves as people that are especially skilled or competent to deal with local conflicts, to regulate life, to punish crime.
And then you want to, one of your key arguments is that to de-orientalize the study of Taliban and Afghanistan, and that's why you suggest that there should be a comparative study between the Taliban and other Islamist groups. At the same time, then you argue that the Taliban differ from other Islamist groups on how they institute Sharia law.
Absolutely.
So how do you suggest that we should compare Taliban with the rest of the diverse spectrum of Islamist, radical fundamentalist Islamists, from ISKP to, you mentioned, the Syrian revolutionaries?
Yes, absolutely. Afghanistan has this image of both this epic and backward country, right? There's always this idea that is the horsemen of Kessel and the British colonial agent riding on horseback, and this country where people play buzkashi on one hand, and on the other, it's this country where women have no place in society and the men are backward in every possible way. The problem with this Orientalist outlook is it prevents you from asking the most interesting question or just listening to people. Interestingly, when you when you start looking at legal issues or issues relating to creating a justice system, you're looking at something that is quite technical, right? The enigma that my book asks is how a Taliban judge that is both a Taliban and a judge get recognized as a Taliban, as a judge, sorry, though he's part of an armed movement. How in the context where law is both a political instrument, you can manipulate it. It has even more effect than in any other place. It's a weapon in the war, but also a social demand. There's a huge pressure to get land conflict solved, but also a technical instrument. You can't just it has no efficiency to just say that you're going to build courts. You have to get your court recognized by the people that will use or not use them, by a lot of international organizations that plays a big role in every civil war. And so interestingly, when you look at the Taliban with this question in mind, it's the very same question that the Syrian insurgency, before even the existence of HTS, I did fieldwork in Syria in 2012-13, when people that had demonstrated peacefully took weapon and created armed groups and then had to deal with the fact that they had to govern half of the country, though they didn't really anticipate it. And so they had to create a legal system. Every armed group in every place, not just Islamists, but every armed group creates institution. They have to deal with the fact that they control villages. And so they have to deal with the fact that people come to them to solve their land conflict, their matrimonial issues. People want to divorce, or there was a marriage contract that was not respected and they want someone to help them solve their problems, right? Interestingly, Islamist groups have they have an available set of tools with Islamic law. The fact that Islam is both a religion and a law give to an insurgency that has an Islamist ideology a set of not only tools, but also of people that are formed, that have been trained in applying Islamic law, which is something, you know, the PKK in Turkey and then the PYD in Syria, they had to invent from zero their own judicial system. What they did is they used lawyers that graduated from university, and so very often they basically based themselves in pre-existing laws. Islamist insurgency have a tendency to do that, but also to use the fact that there is Islamic law, there are various interpretations of it. And that's the very place where when you said an Islam an Islamist insurgency has many abilities to apply law, it doesn't prevent the fact that the practices are very different, right? In the same way, Islamic law means something very different from Morocco to Saudi Arabia. In the same way, with the insurgencies, what the Syrian revolutionaries before HTS did in 2012-13, what the Taliban do, and what the Islamic State does in Syria, in Iraq, did in Syria and Iraq, or in Afghanistan and Pakistan, are very different practices. What is singular about the Taliban, and probably their most specific issue, the most singular thing, is that the fact that they are based with this networks of Deobandi religious schools created a sort of straddling, a double positioning. A Taliban judge is a judge because he has been nominated by the insurgency, but he's also considered as competent because he has been trained by an institution that is completely external to the armed movement. Those madrasas have links with the Taliban, but they're not part of the Taliban. And so in the Afghan countryside, the Taliban judge was recognized as competent, not because he was nominated by the Taliban, but because he had graduated from one of the prestigious madrasas of northern Pakistan or sometimes of southern Afghanistan. And this external system of certification that I've never seen developed to such an extent, to such a systematicity in the Malian, in Mali or in Syria, the judges that have been nominated by the insurgencies never had such a coherent background, such an insistent on the institution. And that has to do with Deobandi as a movement and Deobandi and the history of this religious current.
Sure. Of course, so the rule of ulama is not something new, even in South Asian context, both Afghanistan and the Pakistan. But what, according to you, makes the Taliban quite distinct from the rest of these insurgent groups is that they systematize rule of ulama and theologians in terms of bringing them to regulate social relationship. You mentioned your reference to history of Afghanistan itself during 1980s and 90s, where the Taliban didn't exist. Many other insurgent groups, the Mujahideen, constituted courts. They either adopted the ulama or they provided probably a semi kind of autonomous court system within their own neighborhood that they were ruling. So how the Taliban were able to systematize rule of ulama that their predecessors were not able to do the same?
The main difference in the 1980s, you have basically a set of pragmatic attempts to deal with legal issues. So, for example, in Kandahar, the various Mujahideen factions will, in the 1980s, they will put themselves together and let certain ulema judge or create a tribunal, where they said that they would recognize. Well, in practice, it was a bit more complicated. The Mujahideen groups often avoided decisions that were not in their interest, and so those judges never had enough power to impose a decision. So the person that pushed the system to before the Taliban to its most systematic way was Ahmad Shah Massoud, because he was one of the most organized and skilled leader, and so he nominated ulema to be judges in Panjshir or in region under his control in the northeast. But he always was not recognized by the rest of the ulema as someone that had the background and the knowledge that would make him legitimate to nominate and to decide who should be a judge and how should the justice system be organized. The Taliban here differentiated themselves from the rest of the Mujahideen, of the pre-existing Mujahideen faction, from the Hezbi Islami, from all the other actors in Afghanistan, because by being religious clerics, by being ulema themselves, they had this legitimacy to say who should be or should not be a judge. They also had something else. By being graduate of the Deobandi Madrasa, they had a bureaucratic culture. Those madrasas, contrary to most religious current in Sunni Islam, are very centralized. Right, one of the difficulties for Islamists in the Sunni part of the Muslim world is that religious legitimacy is very decentralized. It's very fragmented, right? It's not the case. It's not the case with the Deobandi current that is very is structurally organized around those schools, where prestigious scholars have an ability to organize the rest of the clergy below them. And the Taliban used that organization of the Deobandi Islam, the fact that it's a very rational type of religious current. It's both a fundamentalist and a rational one. Fundamentalist in terms of coming back to the letter of the Quran, but rationalist in terms of considering that there is something to be taken in scientific education and in rational and bureaucratic organization. And so the Taliban applied what they had learned in school, basically. They organized a pyramidal system of justice using the 1964 constitution to construct the courts. They institutionalized the procedures. They institutionalized the recruitment process. They created an exam. They did exactly what they had seen and learned in school. The only exception to it, and it's a very important one, is Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar himself is not a graduate of those schools. He's so not legitimate that Darul Uloom Haqqaniya, the most prestigious of the religious school, of the Deobandi religious school in northern Pakistan, had to give him a honorary diploma to feel the fact that he had no religious education, that he was a typical example of lower clergy. He was a mullah, a village mullah. He had no higher education. And he's a typical example of a charismatic figure. Basically, he was a non-graduate among graduates, and he was especially able, and here he basically used the prophetic tradition in Afghanistan that had existed at least since the 19th century, that has been so important in the Anglo-Afghan War, for example, of what the British would call a mad mullah, but basically of someone that would convince his surrounding that he had a special link with God. Mullah Omar was saying that he was dreaming, and his dreams God would talk to him, that he had a special link to God that would make him even more able to interpret the word of God than people that had been educated in the madrasas. And so there is here a double logic in the Taliban, a charismatic logic around the leader, but an organizational and a bureaucratic one among the executives of the movement that have organized both the armed movement and the judicial system.
Sure. But despite the fact that the Taliban bring in the ulama from the madrasas and incorporate it into this state order, however, they do not observe the hierarchy which exists in madrasas while transplanted. You mentioned the example of Omar. Mullah Omar was not a scholar. He was not a scholar even to the extent that many other conventional Maulavis would have been. But even Mullah Omar is not an exception, I think, in the case of Taliban. There are many other Taliban middle-ranked leaders who are not educated. They are not actually a mullah or maulavi or sheikh, whatever you call it. But since the fact that this constancy of ulama constitutes the base of the regime, so that's why many other people try to adopt this title in order to get legitimacy. So simply the question would be, not to challenge the core of your argument, but aren't we giving so much credit to the Taliban, both in terms of their leadership, middle rank, and insurgents, and the rank and file, that they, while they are not educated, but we try to, for example, your argument is that they have instituted the courts. The courts were centralized. There were certain procedures. Even during the insurgency, that those due process were observed. So a little bit trying to push you on that. So how do you see that we are not over crediting the Taliban for what they have or they don't have?
No, you're absolutely right. They organize the system, and then there are two parts in what you're saying that are important. The first one is that the Taliban always had a tension between the fact that their discourse and the sociology of their executives in the administration, in the civilian administration part, most of the case, were ulema. And the fact that, they are in the civil war. And so the main skill here is not how you judge, how you interpret Islamic law and your ability to apply it, but your ability to lead men into combat and to organize military resources, right? And it's a tension that always existed within the court system, for example, between the fact that the ulema managed to monopolize in a very clear manner nomination in the judicial system, right? To be a judge, you had to have a diploma. But to be a commander, you did not. To be a commander, many people rose from the ranks, especially in the 2000s when the U.S. Special Forces and the CIA started targeting the mid-commanders in a very systematic way. Thousands of them would die every year, so you had to replace them. And mid-commanders, when I come to Afghanistan in 2009, often have 25 years old. They're very young. They very often have some relation to the madrasas, but not systematically. Very often, they have not finished their diploma, even the primary one, because they wanted to go into combat. Because the madrasas, in relation to Pakistan and to the Taliban, were pushing and promoting the going to jihad against the Western coalition. And so there was an incentive among the students to stop the studies and to go fight. And so people would rise from the rank and become very, very important, prominent figures among the Taliban by being central figures on the field. One figure that is typical of that also is Haqqani, right? Haqqani is a typical case of what you're saying. He's someone that has a very limited education, but he's so important politically that the Taliban had to integrate him. And there are many, many examples of that. So, you know, you had commanders like Maulawi Ismail, that was a very important figure in the military commission in the 2000, that was an ulema that graduated from the madrasa. But you had other figures, and some managed even to be called Maulawi, to be considered as alim. But that had that had very little religious background.
Right, right. And I think this goes back to the right, even to the moment, to the inception of the Taliban. In 2022, when the Taliban tried to commemorate the founder, the leader, Mullah Omar, so they published the very first speech of Mullah Omar in that the initial shura. And Mullah Omar in that lay out a vision where he differentiates between the ulama and the Taliban, the Talibs, he says, the food soldiers, basically. So he says the food soldiers are going to fight this war in order to pave the way for the ulama who has the knowledge of Sharia in order to implement the law of God in the land of God. So that the vision of labor has been right at the beginning of the movement between the Talibs, not really educated in religion, but the ulama also. Now, that also explains, you mentioned Haqqani, Sirajuddin Haqqani. So that, I think, explains to a large extent why Haqqani, a figure like Haqqani, cannot really challenge the authority of Haybatullah. Or the leading Rahbari Shura, who are constituted of these ulamas. I'm raising this because this is an interesting point. Many analysts try to bet on this point that there is a cleavage between moderates and the radicals that you mentioned at the beginning, which is misleading. So the leader of this moderates or pragmatists, let's say, is called Haqqani, and he is associated with certain form of probably leverage or social capital or political capital to challenge. And so basically, listening to you, that is not possible at all because he doesn't have that credentials, which is required in this political system of the Taliban to challenge Haybatullah.
No, absolutely not. You know, there was always this discussion since the 2000, and you still have it a bit, of the Haqqani network and this opposition, as you say, between moderate and radicals. First, this is not something that has to do with the situation on the ground. It's a sort of scheme that you impose from a situation to another. The same was said about the Communist Party in Moscow in the 60s, 70s. You had the moderate and the extremists. It's something that has more to do with the way the US and, in a larger way, the West look at its foes or the rest of the world. You also have those type of discussion about the Chinese Communist Party, right? It has nothing, it's not taking into account of a situation. It's a scheme that people in policy oriented circles or in media or academic circles will tend to impose on the situation. From looking from the ground, what was fascinating is that the judges from the movement were rotating from a province and a district to another, and that included the southeast, the stronghold of Haqqani. And okay. So if you had judges that were moving from a place to another, then it meant that the structure was unified. If the structure is unified, what is the autonomy of Haqqani? Right? Maybe Haqqani had closer link with Al-Qaeda. Yes, maybe. But what is clear is he never had a political autonomy of the type of someone that could have his own movement outside of the Taliban. When he entered the Taliban in the 1990s and when he accompanied them in the insurgency from the start of the 2000s, he was part of it. He was one of the strong leaders. His roots in the Southeast made him able to keep his authority here, but as part of the movement. And here you see that the very idea of moderate and extremist does not make sense. It's a very bad category to think of the Taliban before and today. The Taliban are both pragmatic and very ideologically oriented. They want to apply a political program that gives a monopoly of power to the ulema, instrumentalizing people around, doing exceptions to it, right? At the end of the 1990s, there were several Taliban ministers that had their children studying in England, right? They have a big discourse about the fact that they are not corrupt, but then there's a practice. And of course, the Taliban are not who they say. But that's more interesting in a sense to analyze than this Manichaean opposition between, or caricatural opposition between moderate and extremist within the movement.
Right.
Age also is a stronger predictor of position and a more interesting element to do the sociology of the movement. And here it's a paradoxical one. The young are more radical. They have a demand for a more systematic application of the ideology than the old. But it's not a division of the movement. It's a typical problem of sociology that most parties have.
Right. So let's go back to the question that how the Taliban were able to reconstitute itself, both in terms of insurgency, but also their courts. So you, in order to do that, you'd give a good explanation of what went wrong in 20 years of the Western intervention in Afghanistan, explaining the weaknesses of judiciary and the law under American intervention. So in that, you characterize it as a transnational government, the Third Republic of Afghanistan as a transnational government. And in some places, you also consider it as a regime. You call it a regime. So explain what do you mean by a transnational government, and then why do you call it regime?
Yeah, one of the core arguments of the book is that the success of the Taliban mirror the failure of the Western intervention. And the way the U.S. especially, because they were the key actor in the Western coalition, but in general, the Western coalition did their intervention was by putting in place a government that was very much related to the way the intervention functioned, right? I'm speaking of regime here in a very typical way in political science. I differentiate from the state from the regime. The regime is a way of organizing the government in a specific moment, right? And this regime, I argue, is characterized by its transnationality, right? Mm-hmm. Karzai, as a figure himself, embodies this transnational nature. He has no constituency in Afghanistan. He's not a popular figure. He's not even a representative of moderation or someone that has a background that is famous for having fought against Islamism. On the contrary, in 1998, Hamid Karzai, the person the U.S. chose to be president of Afghanistan, was someone that had asked the Taliban for a position in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Right? If you want to characterize Karzai's opinions, he's a fundamentalist. There's no much difference in the vision Karzai has of gender relation. Sure. With the Taliban, that's not a place of big difference, right? That's not here, and so the regime that was created was financially totally dependent on Western aid. It was also constructed in ways that related more to the way Western aid functioned than to Afghan society. For that reason, for example, the constitution, because the U.S. was dominant in the coalition, what was the highest jurisdiction in Afghanistan became Supreme Court, like in the US, right? There was a tendency to copycat the structure in the way the US state functioned. And you'd have those logics even in very small things because the US needed for its fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda a law to go after money that they considered funded terrorism. They basically copied the Patriot Act in the Afghan legislation. The British copied the narcotic laws they needed to do the anti-narcotic struggle. The Italian that were in charge of rebuilding the judicial system copied literally articles from their code of penal procedure in the new code of penal procedure that they've written in 2004, ignoring totally Afghan legal tradition that existed, ignoring, even if you take away what the communist regime did in the 80s, the code of penal procedure of 1978, right? That could have been used just simply because you had Afghan legal scholars that had a background, that had a knowledge of this code, and so it was easier to use than to write a new one. And that logic was everywhere in the function. It was also present in the way the fighting was going on. So, you know, the U.S. Army fought the war, ignoring the very regime that they were funding and creating. They were functioning outside Afghan legislation in a way that is only possible if the regime is totally dependent on the U.S., right? It would have been unthinkable that the U.S. Special Forces would operate how they did outside of any regulation if there was not such a dependency of the regime on the U.S. And so it was structural to this regime. The problem here is that it led this regime to be more oriented towards aid, and it created a very predatory elite that were basically parasiting the state. There was no warlord around the government, as people used to say. Ismail Khan or Dostum were not warlords in the 2000s. They were parasites. Most of their money came from their connection to the government and Western aid and the impunity they could get on drug trafficking, right? It was by being with the government that you would be autonomous and that you would make money. It was not by having a social base. On the country, people wanted to vote. I remember in a very clear way how in 2014, after a bombing on a voting station, in Hazar, in the Hazara area in Kabul, a few hours after the bombing, where several tens of people had been killed, people lined up again to vote in 2009 when Karzai was reelected in an obviously fraudulent election. It was very clear that the election was fraudulent. You have thousands of Afghans that wrote letters to UNDP and to the Western embassy saying, I did not vote for Karzai, and in my district, 100% of the vote are for Karzai. This election has been stolen. That shows that there was a real demand for democracy. There was a real demand for a different type of government. But that was not taken into account by the Western government that could influence the trajectory of this regime. On the contrary, in 2009, this fraudulent election, this obviously fraudulent election, UNDP agents were very conscious of it. I spoke with people from Western embassies that were very conscious of the fraudulent nature of the election. They recognized after a few weeks Karzai as a president because they needed someone to use the word of Zalmay Khalilzad, someone they knew, someone they could trust, someone with which they needed their own interlocutors, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Legal transplant was one of the key failures, but I think these are connected to a larger ideology of liberalism, though you do not, I think, discuss it in the book. Legal transplanting, or for example, outsourcing, and that you argue, and the way outsourcing created problems for the judiciary and the republic, as it did for many other sectors. And you highlight, for example, turnover of foreign experts, mismanagement, lack of coordination, lack of independent evaluation and collusion. So this is something which is not just unique of a state which is created out of intervention, but even you see in established democracies, like in the US, for example, because the system is market-based, so so many things are outsourced. CIGAR, which was mandated for the oversight of whatever U.S. spends in Afghanistan, has highlighted several times that this outsourcing has been a problem, but no one has addressed it because it was a, I think, key component of the entire political economy of the system. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Interestingly, after my book on Afghanistan, I started, which in French was published before. So I've been working since a few years in Mali, where you had another Western intervention in a state that was pre-existing, but where aid has always been something central to its functioning. And here too, it was a form of transnational government. It was a form where key decisions about the future of the country would be taken in Bamako, but also in Paris, in Brussels, in Washington. What happened in Afghanistan was just an extreme version of it. Extreme because the Western intervention was made with more money. It was the level of money that was spent over the Western intervention was incredible, but 75% of it never reached Afghanistan, right? This outsourcing of which we are talking about is a system where basically the State Department, through its aid agency, USAID, will have a contract to do whatever, reconstructing of courts, for example, in the countryside. And only companies that are certified by USAID can answer, can compete to get the contract, right? But we're speaking about companies that are Washington-based. They have no dealings with Afghanistan. And so what they did is they outsourced to a company, very often a binational, someone that was Afghan-American, for example, that had a company that was both in Washington and in Kabul. But he really had no great links with Afghanistan today. He mostly would do back and forth to Kabul and come back to Washington. So he would outsource to an Afghan company. But this company itself would not have any relation with what happened in the countryside. So this company would outsource itself. And so on and so forth, which in the end, we always spoke about the corruption of Afghan society. First, there's no science, if you look at the history of Afghanistan, that there is a specific social mechanism of corruption in Afghanistan. The monarchy in the 60s was, yes, a bit corrupt, but not systematically corrupt. The communist regime showed that it was a highly ideological regime constructed around party membership, very extreme in that sense, but absolutely not corrupt. Corruption to that level is actually particular and singular to the functioning of the intervention. And interestingly, I absolutely agree with you, it has more to do with the functioning of Western society than it has to do with the functioning of Afghan society. What you find here, a neoliberal mechanism, when we speak about outsourcing, or way older mechanism when you speak about legal transplants, that exists in Western society. When you look at infrastructural policies in France or Germany, if you look at the way the health system is managed in the US, you'll find mechanisms that are very similar. In a sense, the exceptionality is that the oversight is very low. When you look at foreign affairs, basically, the CIGAR is here an exception, and even CIGAR, that is an incredible enterprise, an incredible source of information. The CIGAR report tells you a lot about what happened in the US part of the intervention. Even CIGAR had very little effect. Very little of the money that has been spent by the US and that has been used in legal but obviously fraudulent ways have been reclaimed back by the government. It was you could speak of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan as a privatization of of U.S. public money, as an incredible process of privatization of U.S. public money. So when we speak about the corruption of Afghan figures in the regime between 2001 and 2021, and especially until 2014 when most of the money was being spent, In practice, it's about 25% of the money that we're talking about where corruption could play a role. Most of the loss of money and inefficiency of money had to do with the organization of Western states and the functioning of outsourcing as of expertise. That's the last element that's quite key to the story we're talking about. The fact that people were systematically saying things that were wrong, for example, that Afghanistan is a country where everything is local, said Jones. People were wrong about the Taliban. The Taliban is an aggregate of tribal groups. The fact that people were wrong all the time, the fact that the Taliban were about that they were weakening. You would hear in 2009, 2010, Afghan experts that would tell you, the Taliban are really weakening at the moment. The fact that they were wrong never changed the fact that there are still central experts, and that's key to the functioning of Washington today, to speak about Afghanistan or to speak about other contexts of armed conflict, whether it is Ukraine or another place.
Right. So you mentioned another interesting point about the tribalization of Afghanistan, and you discuss it in the book, and I think that's a very strong argument. Recently, there has been so much debate about how Taliban are tribal and how Afghanistan is tribal. The leader of HDS in Syria referenced to Afghanistan that is quite different from Syrian society. Afghanistan is tribalized. I was so much pissed off with this argument. That's why I wrote my PhD on negotiating cultural diversity in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is much diverse rather than being tribal, that some argued. So you argue in the book that the U.S. intervention, they tried to revive the tribes. They tried to interact with the tribes as a primary interlocutor, looked at Afghanistan from the prism of tribalism. They also revived the customary institutions, and that all bypassed the formal institutions of the state. In fact, what you're writing to my idea, argue is that last 100 years of state institution building in Afghanistan has transformed the society. So the society is not at all tribal to that extent that you and that many argues.
Of course. Of course, the very vision of Afghanistan as a tribal society is related to the ignorance of historical works by very important Afghan and Western scholars that have shown repeatedly and in a very clear way that if there is something that characterized the last century of Afghan history is detribalization, right? Faiz Ahmed's book on law is an amazing example here. He shows very well how far from being a process of far from being a state where everything is solved through customary institution, on the contrary, you had a process of legal construction of a legal tradition in Afghanistan with influence from Turkey, from India, from various places, including Europe and the US, that led to the construction of a state tradition. Afghanistan is a country that has a very strong state tradition. Even the region that is considered as the most tribal, the Southeast, where it is true that you still have tribal type of organization. The last serious anthropological study about tribal justice or customary justice dates from the 70s, right? What has been done in the 2010s were often very highly funded studies with an objective that was to promote the use and the organization of what would be called customary justice, but was most of the time basically councils funded, either by the U.S. Army or by transnational NGOs or by local NGOs. You had an NGO really related to intervention that was called the Tribal Liaison Office, with the very idea of constructing tribal ways of solving problems in Afghanistan that had nothing to do with Afghan history. The last study, even is from the 70s in the Southeast, of the use of customary law, shows that already in the 70s in the Southeast, the most tribal region of Afghanistan, only the majority of the conflict was being solved outside the courts. Only the majority. It was already in the process of detribalization. But the war, and this is a case of every civil war, detribalized even more what remained, right? People that had a claim for a lineage type of legitimacy in the 80s, very often they died or went into refugee camps in Pakistan or Iran. Most of the people that became prominent figures in the villages in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s are basically people that were commanders, people that had, in a way or another, military resources, a social capital that allowed them to mobilize people around them. And they had nothing to do with a tribal tradition. They had to do with a civil war dynamic. And it was those people that many people in the US or in Europe decided to make them interlocutors, despite the fact that their authority in the villages were very much resented, for example. It was very clear in Kunar that people that had become strong figures because of their action in the 1980s jihad against the communist regime in the Soviet Union, but had also played a big role in the civil war in the 90s, when they became interlocutors of the US, that delegitimized the US intervention in Kunar. Despite the fact that in 2001, when the US troops entered, they were quite popular. The fact that they allied themselves with the strong figures of the previous era, of the era of the 1990 Civil War, considering them as customary authorities, actually played a big role in the Western defeat in Afghanistan.
Right. Now, another interesting question that I would love to ask you is, to put it directly, do you consider Taliban as a totalitarian movement? There's a vast literature on how Islamism is a totalitarian ideology, and Islamist groups are a totalitarian in nature, given the fact that simply they do not accept the division between public sphere and private sphere, in the sense that a totalitarian movement and ideology tries to reshuffle, redesign, and penetrate the private sphere, the minds of individuals. They do not accommodate civil society as an independent sphere, and then they deal with individual directly to control it. It's not just physical control, but it's also the way that you think. But I see that in your book, you go towards an argument that one of the classic scholars' articles on the Taliban, Jon Kole, write about the private sphere, Hegelian private sphere and the Taliban, where he says that, well, the Taliban regulations merely try to deconstitute the society, but as far as the private sphere was concerned, many Taliban even stated that we are not concerned about applying of Sharia when it comes to, for example, someone's household. It is their responsibility to do. And so you also develop the same argument to say that Taliban differentiate between these. And you also, I think, quote some of your interviews. But to my understanding, the Taliban go beyond that. And literally, it's not about whether you're inside the walls of your house or outside in society on the street. The Sharia that they implement, for example, the way they simple things about their attire or the beard, the hijab, or the way that you should think, whether you should have a secular education, you should have a right to go to university as a woman or not, what to study, what not to study, what should be broadcast on media and what should not be, the censorship, the books that are censored, many, many books, including mine, has been collected from Kabul and provinces. So there's literally not much differentiation between the wall of public sphere, private sphere. They infiltrate all of it. So isn't it a totalitarian movement?
I argue that this is not a good adjective to describe them. The problem is basically most of the time when we speak about totalitarian, what we want to say is really, really bad. The fact that the Taliban is the worst regime we can think of. And in a sense, it would be better to say it this way than to use the word totalitarian, because it does not, you know, when we say totalitarian, we are thinking of Hannah Arendt's argument and the way fascism and Nazism had the vision of reconstructing the individual and inventing a new man. The Taliban have no such ambition They are a very violent movement. They are a movement that is extremely authoritarian. We agree. There is very few public liberty under Taliban rule. Absolutely agree. Most importantly, and it's, I argue in the book, it's key to who they are. They have a vision of society that is extremely gendered, extremely patriarchal, and there's no argument here about the fact that they that at the core of their practice is a set of extremely violent and coercive practices against women. Right? That's not my point. My point is more precise than that, in a sense. It's to say that the Taliban are not trying to transform family life on the country. What they try to do and what they try to uphold is a completely reinvented vision of fatherly authority, right? The Taliban have a vision of, and they express it in their discourses, in their laws. You know, probably the last one is the most representative of that. The very issue removing windows in kitchens or in any place where women can be seen. This is typical of the Taliban. They have an obsession with the public sphere. They're obsessed with moralizing the public sphere and preventing any deviance. When I was doing interviews with the Taliban judges, I would often ask questions about the most coercive sentences that they have given. I would try to speak with them about lapidation, cutting of limbs, executions, decapitation for those of them that practiced them, because it was less practice in the 2010s. So it's only all the judges that had ordered a decapitation. But I was thinking, you know, I'd always start my interviews with questions very technical, and I would keep that for last because I thought that would be controversial. It was actually not for the judges. The judges were very happy to speak about the harshest sentence they have pronounced. They were happy to speak about it because they had a justification discourse of which they were very proud. They would say, you know, people have gone over in Afghanistan. They have lost any sense of moral. It's very important to put people right on the back on the right track, right? The idea that if you let someone steal an apple, then he collaborates with the foreigners and becomes an unbeliever. And so you need to when you have such a discourse about deviance, what you actually are justifying is very harsh sentences for any practice in the public space that goes out of that, right? And so,
but here, let me get you on that. It's not just about public safety and social order in terms of security. So when they talk about certain morality, it's about how an individual thinks and should think. So for example, you cannot be hypocrite, you cannot be apostate, let's say, you cannot be unbeliever. So that is a kind of totalitarian system.
It touches the individual, but what it leaves, and what is very important for the Taliban here, what is actually, I would argue the reverse of the argument about totalitarian. I would argue that the Taliban, what they do is they constitute the private sphere as a sphere of where there's no legality, where there's no law. A law is something that oppresses people, also protect them, right? What is interesting is where the Taliban never do not respect their own regulation, because the Taliban have a big discourse about respecting the law, but there's one place where they never respect the law, or quasi never. It's when it's about domestic violence or anything that has to do with a patriarchal authority, with the authority of the father of the family, right? On the country, you have in Mullah Omar's discourse, and in the same way in the discourses of the judges that I would do the interview with, a lot of speech about the necessity to reconstruct family authority, of the fact that now children do not listen to their parents, right? There's an obsession that is not actually only the Taliban. You hear that in Afghan society, you would hear that in Afghan society a lot, that now children are not listening to their parents. They become corrupt in a sense, morally. the Taliban are not trying to get into individual as such. They're trying to reconstruct family authority. And the family here, where the head of the family had an absolute right to violence, right? That's my argument against the characterization of the Taliban as totalitarian. I think it misses what is more important here. It's that the Taliban tries to create a family authority all powerful, and you would see that in 2021 when they took over Kabul and the main cities. The way they let family members of progressive female figures beat them up, rape them, or kill them. You have between September and December tens, hundreds, maybe more. We don't have exact precise figures of women that have been relatively prominent figures at the local level or at the national level that has been beaten, but not by Taliban militants, by their brothers, by the uncle, by the neighbor, by all the male figures around that had considered that this woman have not respected morality, that they were speaking too loud, they were too visible, and those people were given a blank check to do the repression on those women. It was not a systematical policy of repressing those women. It was, and that's very Taliban-like, letting them do, right? You see what I mean? And then later on, they started disappearing.
I think my point is not in contradiction to what you say. I totally understand what you say, and that is true. And that comes from the Taliban's religious understanding. And one of the very popular verses of Quran, which says that الرجال قوامون على النساء, the man has authority over a woman. And so in that case, even the Taliban are not violating their own moral conduct or law, whatever it is. Given the fact that the Taliban reconstitute an authority based on patriarchy in the society, and that is the rule of one man in family, that still I think that does not constitute them as a non-totalitarian regime. It could be a totalitarian, and it does all of these things as well at the same time. Those things are not necessarily in contradiction with each other.
No. Where we also agree is that such a system gives very little individual freedom. That it gives almost none. You know, you have the freedom to cultivate your field. You have the freedom as a woman to do a bit of craftsmanship on the side, and that's all. Afghanistan is today a country where there is a very bleak future for individual that wants to. To study literature, that wants to play music, that wants to fall in love with who they want, right? A dynamic that was very visible in Afghanistan in 2010s, how the youth wanted marriage contract to be over and wanted the very basic and fundamental right to fall in love with whoever they want and to choose their own life. You had a very popular radio broadcast show where people would speak at length about their love stories in the 2010s and was incredibly popular and was telling you something about the aspiration of Afghan societies. Well, what happened in Afghanistan now is that those aspirations have no place, clearly.
Yes, that's right. I do agree with you that individual freedom doesn't exist. So anyway, so moving on, probably the last question or the last segment that I would ask you, as we discussed, the Taliban constituted an order and court system, which is originating from madrasas. And given the now vast number of madrasas resting in this both side of the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, do you think and a resistance, civil resistance or otherwise, is possible and successful against a Taliban, which is established such an entrenched kind of order? Any other resistance social movement or group, what strategies they should adopt in order to challenge the Taliban, which has a vast number of followers in terms of these madrasa graduates, that they can be their judges, they can be their foot soldiers, and do whatever for the survival of the regime.
I have a very pessimistic and bleak outlook on the future of Afghanistan now. I don't think the people who present themselves as the civil resistance in Afghanistan today have much ability to change the regime, because on the one hand you have people that with military background that are related to the regime because the previous regime, the Karzai or Hamid or Ashraf Ghani's regime, and because of that are deeply unpopular. They've been very corrupt figure. I mean, the resistance in Panjshir, Panjshiris have had control of a security institution during 15 years and have become highly unpopular in all the rest of the country. On the other hand, you have a civil resistance movement made of people that resist by marching peacefully or promoting forms of resistance. They're just civil activists, basically, but they have no military power or no civil base that would allow them to change a regime that is so coercive and so authoritarian. What is key today to what happens, I think, is the diaspora. Because most of the people that were opposed, you know, you can sum up the 43 years of civil war in Afghanistan. If you had to, one of the key dynamic that has gone all along in this war was this competition between graduates of the universities and Kabul University, and then all the other universities that were created in Herat, in Mazar-i-Sharif, in Jalalabad, and all those, with graduates of the madrasas, right? The Taliban's victory is the victory of the graduates of the madrasas against the graduates of the universities that have been the executives of the communist regime and then have been the executive of the regime created by the Western intervention. Those people that are more liberal, more progressive oriented, they never had the power, really, but they were the mid commanders, let's say, of this regime. And those people have all gone outside of Afghanistan, either in the region, Iran, India, Pakistan, or to the West, Australia, the US, Canada, Europe. And those people have an instrumental role, because if you'd like to compare Afghanistan's situation to something similar, the best comparison is Iran in 79 or Spain when Franco takes over in 39. And those situations shows you that despite the fact that there is no possibility for internal opposition that could lead to regime change in short or mid term, you can have an outside opposition that prevents normalization and ensure, in a sense, that there is a voice for a different way of organizing and of administrating and of governing the Afghan society. And that is something actually very important. In Iran, the diaspora never managed to change the regime, but in Spain it did. Afghanistan will change for reasons that are mostly external today, though, despite the fact that the West will not intervene, that no one wants again a civil war in Afghanistan. Everyone wants stability in Afghanistan. And if change there is, it's in a longer term, I hope not too long, but in the longer term, it will have to do with changes in the international situation, in the regional situation around Afghanistan, and the fact that this diaspora had worked thinking about its own mistakes when they were working for the regime, for those of them who did, about what are the aspirations of Afghans, as the diversity of them, how to put them together, how to think the future of this country. That will play a big role if there is an opportunity let's say, in 10, 20, 30 years.
Sure. Thank you so much, Adam, for this opportunity. This is a wonderful book, The Taliban Courts in Afghanistan, Waging War by Law. And I encourage all of the audience, particularly those who are interested in understanding the movement, and most importantly, those who are understanding to change the situation now in Afghanistan, that to read the book. I think it gives a new understanding. And until analysis, as you mentioned, one does not understand how ulama and the Taliban power social base is, and the prospect for change will be quite bleak. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Omar. Thank you for this engaging discussion. It was a pleasure to exchange with you.